We were kept in there much longer, from what I heard, than someone who, you know, might have just broken a simple law.
Yeah, the conditions were, you know, they had these signs where it says chemical storage area, and I heard from one of the people that used to be some storage area for chemicals. The floor was complete shit, like literally shit.
They were giving us baloney and telling us that it was soy as like a joke. They said it was correctional soy.
They did the Brave New World instead of the 1984.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab Muslim South Asian advocate for the National ACLU. Those were demonstrators just after release from the jail on 100 Centrist Street. They were detained for 2 or 3 days in horrible conditions after being told that they would be held for only 4 to 5 hours. Last month, nearly 500,000 protesters took to the streets in New York City to march against the Republican National Convention, the Iraq War, and actions of the Bush administration. In one of the most peaceful gatherings that New York has ever seen, demonstrators marched for hours in the hot sun from 14th Street and 7th Avenue to Herald Square and back down to Union Square. Meanwhile, a carnival-like atmosphere continued inside the RNC. Outside, unpredictability gripped the streets as police used dragnet tactics to round up protesters.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. There were over 1,800 arrests last week, most of which were for violations such as disorderly conduct. Usually, we see that these charges are dropped. On several occasions, they broke up several large gatherings by sectioning off groups of protesters and, in some instances, cordoning them off with orange nylon net before they arrested them. Today we'll talk to New York City attorneys Elizabeth Fink and Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who filed a writ of habeas corpus to release prisoners who had been detained unlawfully for over 24 hours in inhumane conditions.
I'm Michael Stephen Smith, author and New York City attorney. There's been a major development in the Lynn Stewart trial. We're also going to be speaking with Ellen Yaroshevsky, professor of law at Cardozo Law School and one of the lawyers on the Lynn Stewart defense team. The great civil liberties attorney, William Kunstler, saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. At a certain point, it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four attorneys and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you.
I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we're happy to have with us today two lawyers from the National Lawyers Guild who worked hard on protests at the Republican National Convention, preparing and defending. Margaret Ratner Kunstler and Elizabeth Fink from the National Lawyers Guild, who along with scores of other guild lawyers, maybe hundreds, were deeply involved in what happened during RNC week. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Margie and Liz.
Margaret and Liz, what happened on Friday night with the critical resistance? Was that sort of the beginning of what we would see from police?
Well, I was out on the street. And it was beautiful as far as I was concerned. It was a magnificent demonstration. It went for, crossed Washington Street, and there was no traffic up 6th Avenue for at least 20 minutes. So that's the length of the critical mass ride. Critical mass runs a regular ride the last Friday night of every month. This ride was the largest ride they've ever had. In the past, the police have accompanied them, they've done training with them, they've been very supportive. However, the tone was completely different on this ride. It was a show of force consistently and intimidation. And finally, there was the first use that we have ever heard of this orange net. The orange net just blocks off a street, and they encloses people so they can't get out, so that in the normal course of things, when a police officer arrests someone, they arrest someone they see doing something that they allege is a crime. In this instance, it didn't matter what the police officer saw. So from the very beginning, the arrests were illegal. They just rounded up people in the net and arrested them. So what they got was some bicycle riders, some people who were supermarket shopping, people who were walking on the street. Even the bicycle riders should not have been arrested. They were doing nothing illegal. So that started the tone of what was happening, what happened all week, which was a macho show of force on the part of the city administration.
How long were the people who were arrested on Friday night detained?
They were all released by Saturday night by 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And the reason for that was because of the National Lawyers Guild, because what happened was that they had every intention of holding about 140 people who were left at 100 Center Street, the criminal courts building, by 11 o'clock at night. There were still over 150 people who were incarcerated as a result of what happened the night before at Critical Mass. And even though for decades the New York County courts have operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in fact, about a year ago, they stopped what was called the lobster shift, right, which is the late night shift from 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the morning. And even though they knew they were arresting tons of people, they did not reinstitute the lobster shift. I mean, actually, they did because they were forced to. But on Saturday night, everybody intended to go home at 1 o'clock in the morning, leaving over 100 protesters, right, and non-protesters and innocent bystanders and mothers and shoppers in custody until Sunday morning when they got out.
Liz, do you think that they were trying to send a message to future protesters that week that you go on the streets at all, we're going to arrest you and we're going to leave you in jail as a way of discouraging other people from protesting?
Well, I don't know whether they were that overt, but they certainly were about to get people off the street and not get them back on until after this was over. After all, as Margie says, Critical Mass does this every week, every Friday, and the last Friday of every month, and they've been doing it for years, and nothing has ever happened before. And then all of a sudden, because the Republicans are 2 days away, there's this massive show of force and this net and these arrests and the taking of the bikes. And all these people being arrested, over 200 people were arrested.
Like preemptive arrests, really, in some way.
Yeah, preemptive strike. Now, we heard that there was a massive blackout. Margaret and I were the people in charge of what is called the writ squad. And what a writ squad is that there's this thing called the writ of habeas corpus. And everybody sort of heard about it. It was brought to us by the Magna Carta. So it's a 1,000-year-old constitutional law, something called the Great Writ, right? And what the Great Writ does is that you go to a judge and you tell a judge that people are being illegally detained. And you ask the judge to have those people brought into court within 24 hours to determine whether the detention is illegal and whether they should be released. So we took over what was called the writ squad. And what we did was that Margaret and I and Holly McGuigan and Deborah Herbeck, the writ of habeas corpus can be signed, the petition for a writ of habeas corpus can be signed by any Supreme Court judge, which is our lowest court, a trial court in New York. So we asked a Supreme Court judge to entertain us, and rather than having to file a writ, what she did was that she went down to 100 Center Street, got down there at midnight, opened up a part, and told everybody that she intended to stay in that part all night so that she could arraign people. What happened was that nobody wanted to stay all night. The only thing they wanted to have happen was have the protesters stay all night locked up. So when they were forced with having to spend all night doing arraignment, lo and behold, boop, everybody got released. And as of 3 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, the entire jails were emptied out, and it was a new day for Sunday.
Where were those people held, Liz?
Well, first they were taken to the way the situation worked is that people were arrested on the street, handcuffed, and made to go into buses. They were kept on the buses. The buses then took them to Pier 57, which was a pier that the police department commandeered. Even though it was a condemned site, even though it was filled with asbestos, even though it was environmentally challenged. And this is in a situation where there are jails, huge jails in this city, Queens House of Detention, Brooklyn House of Detention, Bronx House of Detention, which have all been closed. And they have room to incarcerate thousands of people. Rather than use those, right, they use this pier. And they kept people in cages in the pier without water, without medical care, without toilets for upwards to 12 hours. They then transferred them from, and also on the pier, there was no equipment to process anybody. When someone gets arrested in New York State, they have to be fingerprinted. And their prints get sent to the central bank, and it comes back whether they have warrants or not. Rather than bring computers over to the pier, even though they said they had planned for this thing and they were going to arrest 1,000 people a day, they had no processing at the pier. So people sat there for 12 hours. They then were brought to either White Street, which is the Tombs, right next to 100 Center Street, or 100 Center Street. People were arrested. This is mostly on Tuesday night. People were arrested at 9 o'clock at Tuesday night, and by 9 o'clock the next night, these people didn't even have an arrest number. They were in the system without any way to...
This is a separate group from critical mass.
Yeah.
That was the critical mass people were there for about 12 hours, but other people got left
there
for...
They were there for 24.
So a lot of people got even more than 24 hours.
Oh, yeah, later on in the week. Mm-hmm. Right. But because we were able to get a judge in there and get everybody out, their first attempt to hold people for massive numbers of days was foiled. And that judge showed an enormous amount of courage by coming down and stopping that.
We referred to that pier as Guantanamo on the Hudson, I guess in some respects, partly because it's preemptive arrests, it's then not taking them before a judge, and it's conditions that are, you know, far below minimum standards.
When the demonstrators were first taken into the pier, and for a long period of time while they were there, there was a sign up that said, danger, asbestos, do not come in without protective clothing. Wow. So it was obviously intentional.
Well, the solution to that would be to take the sign down.
Well, eventually they did.
Now, they then carpeted the pier, didn't they, on Wednesday? I heard they put down temporary carpeting.
They did. They did. But that was after most of the arrests.
Our producer, Jeff Brady, caught up with some of the demonstrators on the streets of New York, and this is what they had to say.
Some of the last people to leave the warehouse saw police preparing for an inspection, rolling out carpet onto the ground that we had been sleeping on. It's one thing if, you know, resources are really tight and they have to put us in a certain place, but to have carpeting available and just wait until we're gone to put it down is really disturbing.
Somebody said they were going to walk through it or something. I don't know.
Well, we tried consistently to get people permission to have people walk through. Margarita Lopez was there on many occasions trying to get in. Lawyers went from 100 Center Street there every few hours to try to get in, and then went back to 100 Center Street and tried to get back to see people. We were not permitted to see anybody, and we argued that if you're holding people for this length of time, you don't even, they're just lost in the system, because people call up and you don't even know where these people are. There's no sense. Hundreds of people disappeared.
This one friend particularly, who goes by Teapot, she got her phone call about 24 hours after her arrest, 7 o'clock Wednesday night. And she called her mother having asthma trouble and having difficulty breathing. Her mother called a friend of hers who called me, and I spent much of the night from probably around 9 or 10 p.m. until 4 in the morning meeting with lawyers, meeting with National Lawyers Guild people, meeting with people inside the courthouse, trying to get her medication, which I had, into her. The lawyers I spoke with were really frustrated. They spent 6 hours in the middle of the night with the guards saying, just a few minutes, maybe in a little while. They finally gave up and went home to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And it was a very shocking event.
Can you just give me a little summary? Because we have the arrest of critical mass on Friday. The next big set of arrests happen when?
on Tuesday when they arrested 1,400 people in 4 hours.
And that was at a particular demonstration?
No,
or
it was all through the city, right? It was the Tuesday night. They had been told that there was going to be civil disobedience. And so, therefore, they made a preventive strike, right, so that that Cheney and Bush wouldn't be confronted by this. And what they did was they took out the netting, and they netted up. It was like the proverbial tuna hunt.
Right. That's what it reminded me of. You're going after tuna, but you're getting dolphins.
Right. And the, I would say over 1,600 people they arrested on Tuesday night, more than half of them. Much more than half of them committed no crime, right? They were rounded up, right, for either because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there are stories that are just unbelievable about the guy who drove his bike down to the Second Avenue deli and bought this enormous amount of pastrami, corned beef, sandwiches, whatever, and he comes out of the deli, and there's a protest going on across the street. Cops standing right in front of the Second Avenue deli, and he says, you know, I'm not involved in this. Get me out of here. The guy says, go over there. The cop tells him to go over there. He goes over there. He gets arrested. They take his bike. They take his food. They handcuff him. They put him on the curb, and then everybody distributes his sandwich, and he's sitting there cuffed on his way, you know, to 48 hours of incarceration, watching them complain that there wasn't a mustard enough on the pastrami. And there were mothers who came with shopping bags coming out of the supermarket. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who had absolutely no interest in protesting, who got themselves caught up and now have been politicized by this event because the conditions and the treatment was so horrendous. I mean, there was no planning of what to do if you were going to arrest people. Now, for me, this is a familiar thing. I mean, it's not the equivalent, but this was, you know, for many years I was an Attica lawyer. And it, as I was sitting there, it just struck me the similarities here between this and the assault on Attica, where there was no planning in the assault on Attica of what to do with all these people that they were going to murder and kill and maim. Well, here it wasn't so overt, right? But it was essentially the same thing. They had these vast people who they knew they were going to arrest, who they bragged they were going to arrest, who they got money for to arrest, and then they didn't even have a sanitary napkin, right, for the young women who were menstruating. They didn't have any medical facility. They said they had four members of Health and Hospital Corporation, but that was, I don't know what that was, but people didn't get medical care. I mean, the city is liable now for millions of dollars in civil rights cases, right, and people are going to get big verdicts because of what the police department did. And when we went to court, the person who defended the city was the Corporation Counsel of the City of New York, Michael Cardoza.
But it looked like when I read the description in the paper that Cardoza was just babbling for words. He said, well, we don't know what happened here. You know, how did this happen? I didn't really get it. You were in court, so you can give us a better description.
Michael Cardoza was our best weapon. He was rude. He was supercilious. He was self-aggrandizing. He didn't know, he didn't have any answers, and he thought he could get away with just bullying even the judges. I think that, as it turned out, that he was the one who made the judges sympathetic to us, who would have otherwise perhaps not have held the city in contempt.
Mark, did you have an interchange with Cardoza? Did you get to speak directly with him or through the judge with him? Were you face to face with him in court?
I actually walked up to him and with a list of people who were we had reported who had various problems and medical problems, and I presented him with the list, and I got a little carried away because he had been so rude to the judge just a few minutes before, the female judge, and I kind of yelled that he would be personally responsible if these people were not taken care of. Not that it had any effect, but it made me feel better.
Well, maybe he will be personally responsible. We could certainly try.
Can you explain why the city was held in contempt? Did they refuse to abide by Judge Cataldo's order to release people on Thursday?
Well, the city is held in contempt for any number of reasons. The first thing, in 1991, our highest court, the New York State Court of Appeals, made a ruling saying that from the time a person is arrested, the state has 24 hours to bring them before a judge. So this law has been in effect for 13 years. Also in 1991, the federal constitution, the United States Supreme Court ruled that they had 48 hours to bring up in front of a judge. And in the Supreme Court case, if you don't get them in there before 48 hours, the person gets released. So what happened was that Wednesday, when people had been held in excess of 24 hours, the Legal Aid Society brought a writ. They went in front of Judge Cataldo and during business hours, and there was an order to the city to release people or arraign them. The National Lawyers Guild went to another Supreme Court judge at 9:30 at night, and she agreed to come down to the courthouse, and there was a hearing held between the hours of 12:30 and 2:30. And then at 2:30 in the morning, she signed the writ of habeas corpus, which brings people into court the next day, and also ordered the city to allow the lawyers access to the people who were incarcerated. The city violated that order, refused to let us in. The next day, the two writs were consolidated, the Legal Aid Society's writ and our writ. We all went in front of Cataldo. Judge Cataldo gave them an order telling them to release by 1:30 a number of people, 127. When 1:30 rolled around, they hadn't released these people, and they have no excuse. Their excuse was this was the largest set of arrests in the history of the city of New York, right? Which we know to be a lie, because we all were alive in 1977 during the blackout when 4,000 people were arrested in about 24, 36-hour period. So then after they realized that that was a lie, they refashioned that statement, and now they say it's the largest series of arrests in the history of Manhattan, right? Which could be true. I don't know how many people were arrested as a result of the draft riots in 1862, but you know what I mean? It could be true. And they had no excuse. Their only excuse was, oh, look at this vast number of arrests, and how do you expect us to process it? Even though they had said they were arresting 1,000 people a day.
They said that months ago in the media.
Right,
it was from Page News.
They had special ways of delaying that were intentional, that had been thought out beforehand. And one of the many ways of delaying people was obviously not taking people to the courthouse. Once people got to the courthouse, they decided to charge everybody with violations. Violations are controlled completely by the police. The district attorney's office has nothing to do with violations. So people who were charged with misdemeanors or felonies got out right away because the DA worked on the papers. People charged with the lesser crimes, the violations, most of the people should have been allowed out on DATs or summonses.
What's a DAT? Explain that.
DAT is a desk appearance ticket. It's supposed to shorten the length of time between arrest and release because you don't have to go before a judge.
The perfect example of it was that there were people that we watched arraigned who were your basic social criminal, right? So there was this one guy, right, who clearly knew the system well, who had been busted for a low hand-to-hand sale, was brought in front of the judge in some incredible, looked like 6 hours, which normally 24 to 36, and he's walking out shaking in his head saying, protesters, this was a good thing. You know what I mean? It was that they were able to process everybody who was arrested in the ordinary course of police activity, right? The burglars, the robbers, right? Anybody, DWIs, they went through right away. They went through quicker than they ever had.
But Liz, you know, right? For us looking at this outside, it does look like it was intentionally done. Yeah. I mean, to really keep people off the streets, to send messages, not to protest, whatever. It doesn't seem like it was just inadvertent or a mistake or they somehow couldn't do it.
No, I think that the police activities showed that it was intentional. The way the police carried out the arrest system was definitely intentionally delaying it. Bob Morgenthau, from time to time, walked through the courthouse just to see what was going on, and he would have conversations with people, and he would explain that he's running for election. He would explain that it wasn't his office that was creating the delay, it was the police. Now, clearly, the police had something going here. We know who spoke at the convention, Giuliani and his chief of police. I think that what was going on here was the police had gotten together and the police decided that they were going to show that they could control the city and that they could keep people away from the convention, and that they would do it by any means possible, and that one way to keep people off the streets was not to let them out again. So they would arrest as many people early on and not release them. And I think that was clearly an intent.
That makes absolute sense to me. And you got a foretaste of it before the convention. You remember all the violence baiting that was going on? The police would release stories to the New York Post. There was one headline about recently released weather people were planning bombings and kidnapping. Remember that story?
Sure, and the anarchists. Now anarchists. It used to be communists. Now it's anarchists.
Now it's anarchists.
Right? But the real thing's always intentional.
But
they know that.
I think they tried to keep people away with this violence baiting, and they probably did keep a lot of people away. But there's so many people that wanted to come. There was just this enormous turnout.
Right.
And then the next thing they did, and they had months and months and months to give people a place to rally. They stalled and stalled, and they came up with that fake excuse that people who have a right to assemble are going to hurt the grass. And remember that? And we got evidence from the guy that planned the planting of the grass in Central Park saying that you're not going to hurt the grass. And they shift grounds, and they had another reason why you couldn't, and they would not allow a rally. And then when all these people were flowing over in the streets, what'd they do then? They picked them all up and put them in jail for 2 and 3 days. I think that this was deliberate, like Margaret says, and it was deliberate over a long period of time.
They're not stupid. I mean, you know, I mean, if you're saying that you're going to arrest 1,000 people a day, you have two options. You can figure out how to process those people and give them their constitutional rights. Right, or you can figure out how to preventively detain them and keep them off the streets, and that's what they did. It's always deliberate. They always have their job, that, as they saw it, was to totally contain these protesters and to minimize them by arresting as many people as they can and making sure that people would stay in for this vast period of time, irrespective of their constitutional rights. That's what they saw their job.
Well, the constitutional rights are fading rapidly. According to our mayor, you don't have a constitutional right to assemble. It's a privilege, not a right.
What about the mayor's role? I know, Marge, you've talked about the police, but the mayor has made some, I think, remarkable statements as well.
Well, certainly the tone set by the mayor in terms of how to behave towards the demonstrators and his view of the value of demonstrations was publicly made, and I think that clearly he was involved. And the reason he was involved is the lawyer who argued for the police department was his lawyer.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking today with two lawyers from the National Lawyers Guild, Margaret Ratner-Kunstler and Elizabeth Fink, two of the main lawyers who defended RNC protesters, went to court to try and get their release, and have played an instrumental role in protecting protest in this city during the RNC.
Elizabeth, I think that despite what they did to try to keep people away and give them a hard time if they came, I think what you said before is absolutely true, that it just politicized people. And I don't think this is going to stop people from coming out again. And I wonder what your plans are in terms of continuing to go after the city for their illegal actions.
Well, I mean, it's always the same thing. First you have the event, and then you have the lawsuits, right? And the event takes a little bit of time, and then the lawsuits take forever. I don't necessarily know that this is going to take forever, but it's certainly going to take a while, and there's going to be tons of lawsuits. These people who were unconstitutionally detained. There are all these people who have chemical burns and rashes from Pier 57. There are these people who were denied medical care. There are these people who were forced to take what is called an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal, a plea, right, because they were so afraid that if they didn't take this plea, they would be forced to go back into detention. They were not allowed to see lawyers. They had bad advice. They were totally blitzed out of their brains from this outrageous conduct. And at the same time that the city was in contempt of this order, these people were forced to take this plea because there is some precedent that if you take what is called an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal, which means that your case gets adjourned for 6 months and then gets dismissed, then you can't sue the city for malicious prosecution. And so people were whipsawed into taking this plea to avoid these lawsuits. Well, ha, ha, ha. The lawsuits are not going to be avoided. At one point on Thursday, I said to Cardozo that what he was doing was creating an enormous exposure to the police, to the city of New York. Millions of dollars were going to have to be paid out to all these people. And of course, he got furious at me. If you know my history, you know that, you know.
I mean, I think they think it was worth it. I mean, I think if you talk to them really, since that they're ever honest, so it'll cost them 10, 20, 30, 40 million to have basically, in their view, put down protest at the convention. I mean, I don't know.
I think they always think it's worth it. Yeah. You know, I think that Rockefeller went to his grave thinking it was worth it to slaughter 43 people in cold blood, right? You know, in order to show people what happens when you rebel. We know that Henry Kissinger walks the streets of New York thinking it was worth it, right? And he's allowed to walk the streets of New York in a, you know, he should be in the same situation that Pinochet is in.
Yeah, the problem is, how do you really punish these people for what they did? I mean, that's really the problem.
You know, and how do you? Well, you hope that morality punishes them. Yeah. And you hope that Martin Luther King was right and that, you know, after it's all over, there's something else. And they all get to come back as cockroaches and I get to swat them right when they cross my sink.
Well, speaking of money, newspapers calculated that the Republicans coming to town cost the city $310 million. The only group that actually made money from the convention was the sex industry. People were coming in from as far away as London and Seattle. So these family values folks contributed some money to that aspect of the economy.
We just heard from Liz Fink and Margaret Ratner-Kunstler describing a truly incredible RNC week in the streets and in the courtrooms. Both Liz and Margaret were part of a small central group of organizers for this event. Their experience in such issues goes back to the 70s. For those of us who were actually in the streets, we witnessed a truly intimidating presence of police last week. Late last Thursday night, for example, I overheard one police officer on 30th Street rushing in with his nightstick posed, proudly proclaiming to his fellow officers, "This is going to get ugly."
Heidi, I thought it was going to be really bad. Did you think it would be this bad?
I actually thought it was going to be a little worse than it was, but I guess in retrospect, the police had to avoid showing a large show of force because they didn't want that to be covered in any way.
I was afraid they would provoke violence and use that as a pretext. They weren't able to do that. I thought that we had a smashing success at the RNC. I think hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who came here were politicized. That message goes all the way home. I have one client from Hawaii who was swept up in one of those orange nets, and her mother's writing articles for the Hawaiian newspapers now about what happened. It's politicized a whole group of people in Maui, of all places. I think that that experience was magnified hundreds of times. This is how a population gets politicized and comes to take things into its own hands and under its own control. And that process is starting to happen now. There's a polarization going on and an education going on. And this RNC really educated a lot of people. I thought we just did terrific.
Recently, the Department of Homeland Security revoked a visa for Tariq Ramadan. He's a Swiss citizen, a renowned Islamic scholar, and one of Europe's rising academic stars. He was due to teach as a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of 20 books, 700 articles, 170 audio tapes. He's worked with the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa. In this past April, he was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential scientists and thinkers. The University of Notre Dame hired him to teach Islamic studies. He got a work visa that was issued in February of this year. It was cleared by the Department of Homeland Security, as is routine. He prepared for the move to South Bend. He bought a house. He enrolled his four children in school, and he shipped his belongings to the United States. But just 9 days before he was set to move to America, his visa was revoked by the Department of Homeland Security. While they offered no specific explanation for the revocation of the visa, they offered a general clue as to why his visa was revoked. Apparently, it was revoked under a part of the USA Patriot Act that changed immigration law. This section authorizes visa revocation because of someone's political activities if they're seen as endorsing terrorism. Under this section of the Patriot Act, visas can be revoked because of membership in a group that publicly supports terror activity or acts in a way that somehow undermines the U.S. effort to fight the war on terror. We don't know which part of the USA Patriot Act was applied to Ramadan, just generally that it was applied. We have with us Jonathan Lawrence. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe, a doctoral candidate at Harvard. He has been writing about the Tariq Ramadan situation. Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jonathan, what do you make of this situation?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate decision by the Department of Homeland Security, and it's an ironic decision in some ways because it would seem to conflict with the government's own stated goals in the wider Muslim world of finding dialogue partners with whom America can have an open and honest discussion in a democratic context about policy differences in the Middle East and the role of Islam in the West.
Why do you think this visa was revoked? I mean, is there any evidence to back up this general claim that he may have endorsed some kind of terror activity?
I would say that at worst, you could say he disagrees strongly with American and Israeli policies in the Near East and in Iraq and Afghanistan. This, above all, his disagreement has made him a target for elements within the administration who are basically afraid of his opinions. He has never endorsed terrorist acts to anyone's knowledge, no one has ever been able to point to any public statements he has made endorsing terrorist acts. But some of his discourses on certain matters are a little bit too nuanced, I think, for the administration's tastes.
So is this a new crime? Disagreeing with the administration?
It's hard to say because they've been so secretive about the reasons for denying the visa while they investigated accusations against him that he was in contact with members of different terrorist networks from Algeria or from Morocco. And they basically cleared his name and apologized to him and allowed him back into territory. So it's hard to believe that the French overlooked something that the U.S. might have found.
Well, I read some of his works, and he has repeatedly decried acts of terror like suicide bombings. We know that he was investigated and cleared by Swiss intelligence, by Scotland Yard, and by Notre Dame. What is it that makes this man so controversial?
He tries not to alienate the Muslim audience he addresses when he makes his criticisms of Islam and of the Arab world. So he is a reformer very much from within. He doesn't want to seem like a sellout to the West, to his base. And I think that even though he is a Western Muslim, he realizes that the people whom you have to convince the most in the world are not the Western Muslims necessarily, or maybe they are the Muslims living in the West who feel slightly disaffected, or they feel that their host societies are not all that welcoming. And so he tries to, I think, to approach the matter, first of all, by telling him, look, I'm a religious Muslim, and I believe in the texts. And as such, he pursues explanations and interpretations of world events that are based very much in the text.
Hi, this is Michael Smith. It would seem to rational minds that a scholar like Tariq Ramadan would be somebody the United States should welcome as a bridge to the Muslim world. And it's so ironic, it seems to me, that it seems that the people that are useful to them are people like Osama, you know, which gives them a pretext to do what they would want to do, and that people who would really be helpful in terms of reaching across and getting a mutual understanding, they bar. And I remember in the old days when it wasn't anti-terrorism, it was anti-communism 25 years ago, under the McCarran Act, the United States would bar scholars from Western Europe who they said were socialists and they're ipso facto violent, and so they couldn't come. Mm-hmm. And it was just slander, but they prevented. And I think this is the central point. People have a right to speak, but they also have a right to hear. And they prevented Americans from hearing other points of view. And in this case, they're preventing Americans from hearing the point of view of a moderate Islamic scholar. And that's a great loss to all of us. That's what they've taken away from us.
Certainly. And they're preventing this Muslim scholar also from hearing American views up close and without any filters. I agree with you when you say it's ironic that they should bar him, given that his goals of reform in the Arab world, of democratic reform in the Arab world, would seem to coincide with the administration's foreign policy. As we know from living in the U.S., however, our policies of democratization are not global in the sense that they apply equally to Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, etc. We have very specific policy of democratization in Iraq, whereas in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, we are taking it slowly for other reasons. Ramadan, in that sense, is less nuanced than the United States foreign policy, in which he says, well, if these are your stated goals, you have to apply them, you know, equally across the region. You know, that's a fair criticism, certainly, and it's apparently the debate that the administration wants to avoid.
For those of you just joining us, we have Jonathan Lawrence at the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe talking with us about the exclusion of Islamic scholar Tariq Ramadan from the U.S. Jonathan, what kind of message does the exclusion of someone like Tariq Ramadan send to Muslims both in the United States and around the world?
I think it's an unfortunate message, and hopefully it's just temporarily an unfortunate message. And I think the Department of Homeland Security will have to review this case. But the message being sent right now is that if you disagree with our policies or the policies of our allies in the Middle East, you're sort of a persona non grata in our sort of intellectual class. But it also sends a message that we don't have much faith in the American model, right? I mean, shouldn't the U.S. society be able to survive an encounter with an intellectual disagrees with some of its policies? It seems to me self-understood that we would be able to have a fruitful dialogue with him, even if we disagree with him on many points. European politicians have been debating him in public on TV for years. The man has not been proven to be a danger, certainly not a terrorist threat. And if it's his opinions we're afraid of, then you know that doesn't reflect very well on us.
This seems to me part of a trend that we've seen in the States since 9/11, where hundreds of foreign students who are either trying to get into the U.S. to study and are from the Muslim world, or are from the Muslim world and have studied in the U.S. and went home for a vacation, are unable to get renewed visas to return back.
Yeah.
To study in the U.S., and they spend as many as several semesters trying to return to the U.S. Do you see this as part of a trend?
Well, there's an association of American universities that actually counts the number of cases where a lengthy security check kept Muslim scholars out of the United States, scholars who then missed their starting appointments, and that number was 60 in the last academic year. Scholars from the Muslim world who missed their starting date. 400 foreign scholars overall missed their starting dates, and a third of them simply went to other countries. We're talking about a kind of brain drain effect where America is currently the leader in attracting foreign minds and the best and the brightest from around the world. And if we're sending a message that we only want the best and the brightest who agree with this current administration's foreign policy goals and the foreign policy goals of our allies, then I think that's somewhat troublesome. and it can only have negative effects on our reputation abroad, and it can only reinforce the impression that Americans are closed-minded, and I think that's unfortunate.
Jonathan Lawrence from the Brookings Institute, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was excellent. He sure makes the United States administration look hypocritical.
Well, he doesn't have to make them do anything. Just shedding some light on their actions is enough.
I mean, really, to disallow a moderate Islamic scholar from coming here and engaging, not even in a debate, because I think most people with their heads screwed on straight would agree with this person, but just to not even allow him to come over here and engage in a discussion, which has been wanting for so long, you know, since 9/11, they have prevented a discussion between us and Muslims. They have prevented asking the question, why 9/11? Bush's answer was evil. They're evil. They hate us for what we have. And that's no discussion. It would have been so worthwhile for all of us to try to understand that. But instead, what they did was just inculcated fear. And by asking a gentleman like Ramadan to come over and have a discussion with us about what's going on in the world and then not allowing him to come in, I mean, it's not like he's coming here. He's coming to Notre Dame University, one of the most conservative historical universities in America. And he's coming to have that kind of discussion, and that's what they don't want to have. Because they don't want people to understand the truth. And the truth is that the United States isn't hated for what it is. You know, it's not hated because we've got a Las Vegas or we've got porn on TV. It's hated for what it does. If we had that discussion, we might learn that political Islamicists hate the United States because we've got military bases next to Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. Or say that we support uncritically the genocide, really, against the Palestinian people. And many, many more examples of what the United States has done in terms of crushing and offending the Muslim world. To have that kind of discussion with a man like Ramadan is something they don't want to have.
It's unreal because it's you see this again and again in United States today, that people are not, the government specifically, is not willing to engage with moderate Muslims. If they're not willing to engage with moderate Muslims, what kind of Muslims are they looking for? It means that they aren't willing to engage with any Muslims. We see government officials unwilling to deal with the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, one of the largest civil liberties groups just exclusively serving the Muslim population. They are a moderate group. They've been accused of supporting terror, and each and every accusation has again and again proven to be nothing. Just like in the Ramadan situation, and yet we see the government unwilling to deal with them.
I'd like to welcome Ellen Yaroshevsky to Law and Disorder. Ellen is a professor of law at Cardozo Law School. She's on the Lynn Stewart defense team, and we're very happy to have her with us to give us an update on the Lynn Stewart case. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you give us an update on the Lynn Stewart trial?
Well, the case has been going on for several months, and it's both frightening and the most boring trial imaginable. Lynn is charged with some frightening charges. She's charged with conspiring with her client, the Sheikh Abdul Rahman, and two of the other people on trial, the interpreter and a paralegal, with, quote, providing material support to a terrorist organization. What it boils down to is the government claims that Lynn Stewart, by making a public statement on behalf of her client, was making a statement that aided the terrorists in Egypt, aided the Islamic group. And they claim that she wasn't permitted to make such a statement because she had signed an affidavit saying that she wouldn't. And I can explain those if you like. The Sheikh Abdul Rahman was Lynn Stewart's client. She went to trial. He was convicted of conspiring to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. He was put in prison for life, and as the government said here, we locked him up and we threw away the key.
Ellen, it seems to me that the hallmark of the Bush administration is that they're willing to do and say anything. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, from the time they stole the election in Florida up to this very moment, for example, going after Kerry, a war hero, that kind of outrage is to me, the hallmark of the Bush people. And it's interesting that what Lynn Stewart is alleged to have done didn't even happen on Bush's watch. It was after he was appointed president that Ashcroft went after Lynn. And the outrages just keep coming down one after another. What do you think about that observation?
I couldn't agree with you more, Michael. This indictment was brought to you by John Ashcroft. He even came to New York to announce it. He went on the Letterman show to talk about it. And it is very clear that the point here is to target a lawyer, to make other lawyers afraid of taking on the trial of people who are accused of terrorism, or if they take them on, not to do a very good job. You have to look at the other cases that they brought. There are many cases around the country where they've alleged that people were terrorists, and they were completely wrong. There's a recent case in Detroit that is a scandal. There is the case of the lawyer who was indicted in Portland. They had to dismiss that. And it's only if we have lawyers like Lynn Stewart who are willing to stand up and represent their client in the most zealous terms and not do what the government wants, that is to say, they don't conduct the defense on the government's terms, that we're going to have a system that functions the way that it should. John Ashcroft came to New York. He targeted Lynn Stewart. She's an easy target. There are other people they didn't go after, obviously. And frankly, nothing happened. What people forget in this case, what Lynn is supposedly to have done, right, making this statement that they claim, you know, was inspiring and encouraging terrorism in Egypt, nothing happened. Nothing happened. It occurred in 2000, and they waited all this time. Until, of course, Bush got elected and Ashcroft came into office, and they wanted to have another attack on our civil liberties that they indicted Lynn.
You know, it seems to be so impossible because of the relationship of forces. The government is so strong. It's a real David and Goliath fight when you get indicted to begin with. I don't know what the percentages are. There must be over 90% convictions of people. And then to come in with this kind of dirt, it reminds me of the Rosenberg case, which, ironically, was tried in the same what they call the ceremonial courtroom. It's like the frame-up courtroom, the show trial courtroom. The judge looked at Ethel Rosenberg, and the government knew at the time that she was totally innocent, and said when he sentenced her to death, you are responsible for stealing atomic secrets that cost the lives of 50,000 Americans in Korea. Well, that kind of like super exaggeration. How do you overcome that?
Well, we remain hopeful that there will be a good outcome in this case. We have a very good jury, and we hope that the jury is going to be able to see through this. It is the kitchen sink, and it's the T word, the kitchen sink of terrorism. They've thrown everything at her, and this week they also throw in Osama bin Laden. If this were a fair trial, in the beginning, Lynn's case and that of her interpreter, Mohammed Yousri, would have been separated from Mr. Sitar, and the trial would have lasted probably 3 or 4 days, because all they have against Lynn, there was an affidavit she signed. They claimed she violated it. She claimed, no, I didn't violate it. At the time I signed it, I intended to do what I said I would do. The conditions changed, and when I visited my client, it was clear to me as a lawyer, I had to make a statement that would help him. It wasn't a statement calling for violence. It was a statement required by my duty as a lawyer, and I didn't violate any law. I just decided that the affidavit I signed I could no longer abide by. That's all they have against her. They have that and the fact she went into a prison, which they, by the way, videotaped, and in that prison had the translator talk to her, and she engaged in language, if you will. She just said things to make sure that the guards couldn't hear them, because you want to make sure, as a lawyer, that the guards don't overhear your conversation. That's the entire case against her. Those are the only facts, and we have now spent months hearing evidence about the Luxor killings, hearing evidence about the speeches and the sermons given by her client. And each time we hear that evidence, the judge turns to the jury and says, ladies and gentlemen, this evidence is either not offered for the truth, it's offered only as background, or it's not offered against Lynn Stewart. I don't know how a jury is going to be able to separate the actual facts against her from this kitchen sink of terrorism, but we're hopeful that they'll be able to do so.
Thank you, Ellen Yaroshevsky, professor of law at Cardozo and a member of the defense team in the Lynn Stewart case.
Thanks for joining us on Law & Disorder. From the four of us, thanks to our guests Liz Fink, Margie Ratner-Kunstler, Ellen Yaroshevsky, Jonathan Lawrence,
and our producer, Jeff Brady.